Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. When Sharon Gaber took over the helm as UNC Charlotte's fifth chancellor in 2020, we were all grappling with a worldwide pandemic and the chaos it caused. So we didn't have an opportunity then to talk about her vision for the campus as the school's first female chancellor. She took over for Phil Dubois, who was active in the community and worked during his tenure to build the school's reputation, its academic credentials, and its campus into what it has become today. Starting humbly, the school has grown with the city and has opened a downtown campus. It boasts a student population of over 30,000 and is the fastest growing institution in the UNC system. So now, with COVID under control and with a few years of running the school behind her, we get to spend this hour with Chancellor Sharon Gaber. Thank you for being here. Sorry it took so long. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. We actually did speak during COVID just to get an update on what was going on at the school, but that's all behind you, and you seem to have weathered that storm pretty well. You are, as I said, the first woman to be the chancellor of UNC Charlotte, but you're not the first woman at the helm of the school. Bonnie Cohn was one of the founders of that school, and she ran it from 1946 to 1966. So given that track record, what took them so long to make a female the chancellor?
Well, I think the university has been blessed with long-term leadership. You know, to be the fifth in 75 years is pretty amazing. So I'm pleased to be here now. And I certainly know that Miss Bonnie helped shape the institution and what we are today, and probably should have been a chancellor. I think lots of people refer to her as the chancellor, but I'm just thrilled to be here and be able to lead. It's been a great, it's almost 2 years now. It's been a great time. Even though we've been in a pandemic, I've gotten to know the place pretty well.
You have several degrees in city, regional, and urban planning. How and why did that academic interest move you into the world of administration of colleges? Because this is not the first university you've run.
Right. So, I mean, there are a couple things. First of all, urban planning, I started out just looking at the way cities work, and I love looking at cities. And I will tell you that's part of why coming to Charlotte has been a thrill for me, because it really is this amazing living laboratory that everything I learned in school is here. I was a professor of planning, and I worked my way up through academic administration at a university. And being the chancellor, or I was a president previously, a university is like a little city. I managed to look at the way we're working together, what's happening with housing, what's happening with our roads, how is our police force working, what happens when there's a pandemic, and how do you run this little city here, and how does our city, the university, engage with the broader community. So it's been a great sort of academic knowledge base to be able to work as a chancellor.
I was going to ask you, because we've had a lot of people on who are teachers who become administrators over the years, and what it is that makes a person who's pretty good at what they do as a teacher suddenly decide that I'd rather run the school. What went into that decision? Is it because these two careers, this urban planning idea and running a school, kind of fit? You're not a chemistry professor. You, as you just pointed out, you deal with infrastructure.
Well, and I think along the way, what happens with a lot of administrators is you've spent time working your way up and leading in different ways. What I've learned as a professor early on is the faculty are critically important, students are critically important, and anybody who's going to be successful in this position has to learn to listen. As much as you lead and talk, you have to listen and understand what do all the stakeholders have to say. And at various levels, I've had that opportunity to listen to different groups. And, you know, I still listen and want to make sure I'm getting that feedback so that I know how we continuously improve what we're doing.
Well, if this chancellor thing doesn't work out, there's a city planning job opening
there you
in
go.
Charlotte. I'm sure that you had more than a few conversations with your predecessor, Phil Dubois, before he left and handed you the keys to the office. Did he say anything to you that you found particularly helpful or informative or insightful that has guided you in at least getting your feet wet and on the ground at the university?
Well, I mean, we did, in fact, during the transition period. And if you remember back in 2020, I was named in April 2020. I didn't start till July 2020. Along the way, he and I spoke every week to really keep abreast of what was going on. And then since then, he and I sort of touch base on regular intervals just to get feedback. I mean, there were things that he would say that just helped me understand how we got to a specific place. I mean, we spent a lot of time obviously talking about the April 30, 2019 shooting on campus, understanding what occurred and then what we've done since that time. We spent time talking about what was going on nationally, right about the time that I was starting was just after the George Floyd murder. So understanding what we were doing with diversity, equity, inclusion on our campus, and understanding what else we probably needed to be doing. So I think those conversations were very helpful. A lot of it was context.
You came in at a difficult, unique, challenging time, just as COVID was hitting. And here you are, a person in charge of the fastest growing campus in the UNC system. And there's nobody on campus because of COVID, and you had to deal with that. What was it like coming into that situation, learning the campus, trying to interface with students and faculty and staff when they're all remote? And how much did it set you back in terms of what you wanted to hit the ground running doing?
Yeah, I think it was difficult. And obviously, I did a lot of Zooms, and I did Zooms with student groups and faculty groups and, you know, different constituent groups. I did it with donors and alums and corporate leaders in the community. It made it for a much slower transition. It meant that I could learn a lot about the physical infrastructure on campus, but not so much getting to know people. And I will tell you, I am still meeting people in person for the first time. And I saw somebody the other day and I said, it is great to finally meet you because I've Zoomed with them quite frequently. So, you know, I think that's what we've all joked about. COVID years is sort of like dog years. It's kind of like each one is 7 years. And I think we're all going to be thinking about how we made it through during this period. But I, you know, you started by saying the campus made it through very successfully. And I think now we're just thrilled to be back and able to do events and get to know people really one-on-one.
I was going to ask you how you would assess the campus and the schools of transition through that period, but I think you're going to tell me it was great, it was fine, it was the best ever. But what did you learn?
Well, I mean, when you say, I would tell you that we were sort of nationally validated. We won the American Association for State Colleges and Universities Award for our COVID response for urban universities. And that's a national award. And it was because we were leaders in terms of the testing process. And we did this wastewater testing. And, you know, I've talked about that in a couple different venues, but we were the first university in the state of North Carolina to do that. And it was led by our faculty who said, I think we can go and take water out of the sewage pipes of buildings and detect COVID before people are symptomatic. This was long before the vaccines. We did that on campus, and we did that in residence halls to be able to get people tested and figure out if there's a presence of COVID in the wastewater, we could get down to the place and figure out who it was and be able to isolate them so there wasn't that spread. Yeah. other universities weren't doing that. We didn't have to pivot and repivot or shut down or send people home or away. And we were really fortunate in that way. And then our researchers started doing this for other buildings and other facilities in the broader community because we have that ability and technology. So I'm proud of the campus sort of digging in. Everybody has said, we want to be here. We want to be open. We will do what needs to be done.
And that kind of weaves into something else we'll talk about later, and that is the move to making this a world-renowned research institute. That's one step in that direction, one would think. We've talked on this program a lot with the primary and secondary educators about this lost year of education because of remote learning during the pandemic. The data shows alarming losses at the primary level of education and perhaps even into high school. I would guess at the college age, what you're missing is the college experience that you would assume that these young people have the discipline and the technological skills to navigate the online education world. But what was there an impact, and how would you assess the impact?
I would tell you there definitely is, and there was and is an impact. I would assume that most universities, and we are part of that, retention rates will be lower. So when you think about people were laid off during the pandemic for whatever reason, or businesses were shut, that meant that families didn't have incomes in the same way. We did have, and everybody knows we had, every university had some federal support. We were able to give grants to students, but if something was going on in a family, if a family member died because of COVID, if they were long-term ill, if a student was long-term, had a long-term illness, or it meant that some students didn't come back or weren't able to continue with their education. It also meant, because this has gone on for a long time, that some students really lost the ability to navigate how do you get up and get back to school and get back in the class. And I think that's happening everywhere. We know that there's the great resignation going on. There's a group of people who don't want to go back to life the way it was. And that's understandable, but it also means that there'll be some shift and shakeout with what does that mean in universities and for higher education, I think.
Yeah, I think we're all, I overslept this morning because the commute is 25 stairs now as opposed to miles. When the UNC Charlotte, and I shouldn't ask this question because we only have a second left, but when the UNC Charlotte campus first opened, it was kind of isolated. It was out there in what is now the university area, but when it opened, I'm not sure there was very much there aside from the school. And your predecessor made moves to kind of integrate the school into the fabric of Charlotte. He opened that downtown campus, which certainly helps, and now you're connected by the blue line. As someone with an urban planning background, talk about what you see as the importance of the mutual benefits that cities and towns have with colleges and universities, and how you build relationships between those two entities. And I've got about 45 seconds.
So be quick, right? Well, I think I have said frequently, every great city needs a great university. And I think you can look across the country and think about that. We are this city's public urban research university, and we are large scale. We're doing the things that help fuel talent supply, help educate the community, and help improve social mobility for individuals. So, you know, we want to continue to make that connection and make sure that we're helping Charlotte and the metro area thrive.
I may get a follow-up to that when we come back in just a moment. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE. I'm Mike Collins, and we're talking this morning to Dr. Sharon Gaber. She is the fifth chancellor in the history of UNC Charlotte, and she joined the school about 2 years ago. This is our first opportunity to really chat about what the goals that she has set for this school are, and we'll get to that in a couple of seconds. I want to go back to the question that I asked a minute ago and gave you an unfair amount of time to answer with regard to the relationship between town and gown, essentially, and how there's a symbiotic, mutually beneficial relationship. And one of the things that you said, you mentioned the word social mobility, and that is something that Charlotte has been deeply concerned about for years. How can the university help with that?
Well, I think we want to continue to work to engage with the community. We are proactively working with the school system, both CMS and beyond CMS, and we want students to be able to come to this university. We have about just under 40% of our students are first generation. Just under 40% are students of color. We are one of the institutions, and I think there's a wonderful ecosystem of higher education in our community, but we're a big provider of higher education, and our goal is to change lives and to help students make those connections to the rest of our broader community to have opportunities that might change their lives.
You weren't completely consumed with COVID in your first 2 years. In those first 2 years, you created a new Office of Corporate Engagement to give corporate partners a kind of one-stop shop to become more easily connected to the university. What does that connection mean for the schools, for the companies who choose to avail themselves of that opportunity, and for Charlotte and the region?
Yes, well, really in my first year, I spent time trying to listen, and I had calls and Zooms with lots of corporate leaders finding out. And your point was Chancellor Dubois did a lot to make sure that people knew about the university. But in my calls, people said, we absolutely know you're there, but we just don't know how to engage. You know, who do I call? Who do I email? So we said, we need a one-stop shop. We need one person or one office that you connect with, and then we will do the work of making sure you're connected to the Belt College of Business or the William States Lee College of Engineering or our College of Health and Human Services. We want to make sure that we're helping you. If you want our students, if you want our faculty, if you want to do research, if you want to give to the institution, we'll make that connection. So I'm excited about the Office of Corporate Engagement. And for anybody, we'd say, give a call or look online because it's an easy way to get connected. And we want people to know that this institution is here to serve this part of the state.
I know this is relatively new, this effort, but have you gotten any nibbles? Has it borne any fruit?
Yeah, absolutely. So the woman who is running it, Solange Trakanowicz, has been out connecting with lots of our corporate partners. And we know that there are new industries to the community like Honeywell or Centene that weren't here 3 or 4 years ago. So those are new connections that we are wanting to make. And I think what we found is virtually every corporate business in our community wants graduates. They want employees. So they want to make sure they have that connection and understand what's going on here and what are the programs that we offer.
Of course, funding is the lifeblood of any university, and not all of that comes from tuition. Much of it comes from grants and donations and fundraising, and you've had record fundraising in recent years. Is any of that connected to what we just talked about, or is that completely separate?
Oh, I would assume that there is some connection. We're very fortunate that we have continued to make those connections. You probably saw announced recently, Truist just gave us a very nice gift. And we are continuing to reach out to make sure that businesses see the great things going on here. We also feel very fortunate the legislature gave us nice funding this year, and we received additional funds to increase our engineering program through the Engineering North Carolina program that they've invested on our campus, at North Carolina A&T and at NC State. So we're excited to be a part of that, and we'll be growing engineering and computer science in our College of Computing and Informatics.
Yeah, Truist just gave you $5.3 million to launch the Truist Institute for Student Success. I can see why that would be important to the school. Why is it important to Truist?
Well, I think Truist has a commitment certainly to underrepresented students, to diversify their workforce, and they certainly want a set of outstanding consumers in this community. So I think there's multiple reasons why they would be engaged and interested, and we're just really fortunate that they see the importance of helping to continue to bring along. It ties into the conversation we had about the importance of social mobility. We want to continue to help move Charlotte forward in that social mobility metric.
How will that Institute for Student Success work?
Well, they're setting it up. So we will have the Truist Scholars Program. We will have the Truist Student Accelerator Program and the Truist Leadership Development Experience. And they are looking at historically underrepresented students to participate in that and to be able to have opportunities then to connect on campus and with their industry.
I don't want to spend a lot of time on this, but I do want to spend a moment on branding, because those of our listeners who are watching us on Facebook Live will notice in the upper right-hand corner of your screen, there is this green C with a pickaxe in the middle of it, the symbol of the 49ers, which is a very clever logo, actually. But a decade ago, we used to call the school UNCC, and then we were admonished to stop that and call it UNC Charlotte. And now, if I'm reading your branding correctly, you're just Charlotte. How did that happen? And what do we call you now?
Well, you thank you. You certainly can call us Charlotte, and you can call us UNC Charlotte. What we did was go through a branding exercise. We unified our logos and we emphasized Charlotte. And what we know is that over time, we certainly have been UNCC, although there have been times when people misperceive the CC as community college. We don't want that identification. Not that there's anything wrong with a community college, but that we are not a community college. And occasionally we are just referred to as UNC, and certainly we are a different entity than UNC. So we decided to be intentional and proud of our location here in Charlotte. And if you look at, and so you can see the logo here, but if you look at the way that we've written our name, we still write University of North Carolina in a smaller font, and then Charlotte much larger boldly to identify that we are Charlotte. So I think sometimes when we're in conversations with the city, it becomes difficult when Charlotte's talking to Charlotte. But for the most part, we're happy to be referred to as Charlotte. And you can see, like, when our football team is out playing, it says Charlotte across their chest so that we're clearly identified. And we decided to unify all of the logos and our references so that people nationally don't have to interpret what does the different brand mean. We have one unified name and logo.
I've been here long enough to know what the school looked like in the mid-80s and what it looks like today. And what it looks like today is nothing like it looked in the mid-80s. Phil Dubois went on a building spree during his tenure, and you've launched this new 10-year strategic plan called Shaping What's Next. You opened up the information gathering process to students and faculty and staff and business people and outsiders. I think you got up to 15,000 suggestions, if I'm correct, on what you, the college, should do next. How did you synthesize 15,000 suggestions from people all over the place?
Well, I'm lucky that we had a team of people who helped hone that in. And I mean, what we did was say, and again, remember, it was my first year, it was a COVID year, we did lots of these Zooms, but we said, we want input. And particularly I wanted it. I wanted to make sure that we were listening, that we were open and making sure that people's comments, interests were widely reflected. So we took all of that feedback and we really honed in on four areas. First of all, transforming lives through educational opportunity and access. We want students to come here. We want them to succeed. We want them to graduate and go out and be great, productive individuals. And then powering the future through research, scholarship, and creative activity. We want to move to be a top-tier research university. And then third, driving progress for North Carolina and beyond by providing innovative solutions to societal needs. And then fourth, leading in diversity, equity, and inclusion and community engagement. So those are the things that we are focused on. Within each of those, there are a number of goals and a number of action items, but we've tried to make it very, so that this isn't just a plan that sits on a shelf. We have metrics, we've posted that online. Annually, we'll be updating our progress toward these metrics and making that information public. We've got people assigned to who is responsible for doing all of the different actions. So really setting it up as an action-oriented strategic plan, and we'll revisit it. I mean, if we're successful in an area, we'll introduce new metrics because we want to keep pushing.
So you're shifting the focus from hard to soft infrastructure, essentially, intellectual infrastructure. Let's talk a little bit more about this goal to transform student lives through educational opportunity and excellence.
Sure.
How do you do that, and how is that different from just the goal of being of having great faculty who know how to teach and know how to do research and write papers and things like that, and to encourage their students to become scholarly? How is that different?
So we keep looking at the ways that we educate students and what are stumbling blocks. So one of the things we're looking at right now is, okay, math classes. Lots of people say that math becomes a stumbling block for them in their success. Our math department has said, let's take that on and figure out, what are we doing? How do we improve the teaching process there? And how do we know that what we're teaching is what they really need? So they have taken that on as a year-long, and they refer to it as a quality enhancement project, to be able to say, can we have better student outcomes for our students? Do you need to know algebra if you're going to be a journalist? Or do you need to understand what advanced statistics look like so that you say, you know, 58% of this population, you know what that actually means? That's probably more relevant in the discipline. So I'm pleased that they're looking at that, and we'll have that sort of wrapped up by the end of the calendar year. But they're continuously thinking about, how do we ensure that our students succeed and that the information is relevant and tangible in what they're going to be doing?
You're also working toward improving the average 6-year graduation rate and reducing the size of student indebtedness when they finally do leave the university. The student indebtedness now, I think, is $29,900 on average per student. You want to take it down to $23,900. But let's start with the 6-year graduation rate. Is that a rate that includes BA degrees, or is that just getting out of college for the first time?
That's getting out of college for the first time. I will tell you that the UNC system as a whole is looking at paring that back and saying, we want to look at 4-year graduation rates. That's what parents expect. That's what students expect. But nationally, the national database looks at 6-year graduation rate. We know that there are lots of students who might take 4.5, 5 years. 6 years is the way the federal government calculates graduation rates. So we're going to continue to work on our 4-year graduation rate, our 5-year, our 6-year. We want students to come here to succeed and to graduate. There's no point in taking out a loan or coming here and starting and not leaving with a degree. Right. If we've accepted you, we want you to succeed. We want the students to do the work, and we want to make sure they leave with a degree.
course, the longer you stay in, the higher your debt goes if you're on a student loan program. So that's important. But let's talk about that student debt. Leaving with $29,000 in debt, that's a significant amount of debt to have at the age of 21 or 22 or 23, and you're just starting out in life. How does it help to reduce it to $23,000? That's also a lot of debt.
Yeah, it is. I think what I know is our university costs just over $7,000 in tuition annually. So then there's a cost associated with living on campus, with a dining program, with books, all of these sorts of things. We add all of those in. We also know that a large number of our students get grants, might work on campus. So I think that's what we're working on, is how do we increase scholarship funds? How do we increase grant opportunities for our students? And, you know, I mentioned earlier, with some of the federal money this year, we were able to give out a lot more money to assist our students to be able to stay in school. Because we are a relatively young university, and think about it, we're only 75 years old. Compare that, for example, to Chapel Hill, which is about 225 years old. Our endowment isn't where theirs is. We don't have the funds to be able to give scholarships and grants in the same way. We're going to work on that and continue to build it up so that we can help our students be able to come here and not have that sort of debt. But again, we are relatively very affordable, and we are working continuously to decrease the amount that students will have to take on.
You mentioned that your math department is looking into why students sometimes struggle with math, or say that math is not their strong suit. They're intimidated by math. And I'm wondering if that's because they come unprepared. And just in general, if it takes you 6 years to get out of school, is that because when you come in, you're taking a lot of remedial courses in either English or math or other basic skills that you need to get through college? Are they coming prepared?
I think certainly we all know that there's a mix. I think most of our students are coming prepared. I think right now the public schools are looking at what are the things they need to do to help students who lost some ability or work by doing this virtual work during COVID. But I think for the most part, we're sort of framing that up for success.
We'll come back and talk a little bit more about that, and then about the 10-year goals and about your goal to become this major top-tier research university in just a moment. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. You're talking to Dr. Sharon Gaber, who is the fifth chancellor at the University of North Carolina at Charlotte. Took over about 2 years ago. This is our first opportunity to really drill down and talk about goals and aspirations and what she envisions for that campus and that university. Just before the break, we were talking about our students coming to you adequately prepared. And I asked the question because we do a lot of shows about CMS and the public schools throughout North Carolina. And one of the things that we know, because the data shows it, is that that year of the pandemic exacerbated a problem that already existed and seems to be getting worse, where they cannot read or perform at grade level. Well, when they get out, and they all get out, some of them come to you and other schools. And I'm just curious if the public schools are doing a good job in your mind. And I know this puts you in a difficult spot, but are they doing a good job?
Well, thank you for recognizing that. What I tell you is the public schools, we all know, can continuously do better. We hope that they're going to work toward doing that. We also know they're going to be engaging in broad-scale tutoring programs to assist students K through 12. And they put out an RFP to help start doing that over the summer and next academic year, because they recognize that they have to embrace helping students be able to get up to grade level. So I think there's more to be done, and we take some of that. There are a couple courses that we have that are run as courses that embed some of the remedial material into them to be able to bring students up to speed. We recognize there are times when students have successfully graduated, but may not be quite where they need to be. And so we help to bring them up to the appropriate level to so that they can move forward and be successful and get a degree.
Some colleges and universities have taken to no longer requiring ACT or SAT tests to get into the school. Do you still require it? And even whether or not you do, what's your take on that? Why are they taking that step?
So that's a determination made by the UNC Board of Governors. We haven't been requiring it the past 2 years. We are not again this next year. And then
Why?
They will make a determination. Because there's still limited access, because there are still places where people are doing work virtually, because we know that there has been this learning gap during the pandemic, and because there is some argument that I think some data has borne out that there are differences in the ways that individuals access based on demographics, that there might be differences and disparities that come out. So I think we have learned that, in fact, the best predictor of student success is generally their grades in high school. If the UNC system goes back to requiring it, we will be part of that group, obviously. But right now, we're fine with not having it.
So are you saying what I've heard, and it may be incorrect, but that standardized tests often have a built-in bias that disenfranchises certain groups of people? Is that what you're saying?
I have heard that also. And yes, I think there is that built-in bias that we know that there's a way that
if we all have a common educational experience, if we all come up through the schools, be they public, charter, private, we've all gone through that system. Shouldn't we have a common standard understanding of what we've been taught that can be reflected in standardized college entrance exams?
Probably, although what we all know is that there are variations in schools across the state, and there are variations based on geographic locale. So I think that, you know, right now, what we're trying to be able to show is what does it look like and how do we measure student success without students coming in with a common standardized test? And can we demonstrate over time that students still succeed in the same way to be able to show the value of it or not have the value? I mentioned the math department earlier. Because they don't have ACT scores, they're needing to look at placement into different levels of math in a different way. So it has a ripple effect throughout the university, and yet everybody's working to adapt to be able to find maybe better ways or different precise ways that would help to make sure students start at the right level.
One of your goals is to prepare students to thrive in a changing world. And when I read that, I thought, okay, that's great, but how is that different from what college is supposed to do in the first place? How is it different?
Yeah, and I think part of it is that we recognize the world does keep changing. We want our students to be actively engaged in internships and multiple internships. We're excited about the connection by light rail and the opportunities at the Center City building, the Dubois Center, as it's now known. And we want students to make sure they take full advantage of that. So I've had the opportunity to talk to students who say, yeah, this is the best place for me because I can hop on the light rail and get to Uptown and make sure I am learning what are they doing in artificial intelligence. And how do I take what I'm learning in the classroom and apply it in this industry? And I do think that in some universities, students don't have that full range of opportunities to do internships because they aren't as proximate to a large urban center.
You are, as one would imagine, aiming for academic excellence, and I assume that is led by the faculty. The 10-year plan that you have also stresses integrity and respect, in which all university members are treated with respect, fairness, and dignity. I don't know what the situation is at UNC Charlotte with regard to the adjunct faculty, but I do know over the last several years, because I've been reading about it in the New York Times, and we've had a conversation about this with some adjunct faculty members from colleges and universities across the country, that they feel marginalized, that they feel a lot of the work is dumped on their shoulders and they don't have a tenure track. They don't have benefits. They're paid substantially less than the fully tenure track faculty. And I'm wondering, and they say they feel as a result disrespected. I'm wondering how that figures into your goal.
I think that we are probably very comparable to what's going on nationally. And yet what we have to do is figure out the strategy to engage those faculty a little bit more and to help with salaries. And, you know, in the state of North Carolina, our faculty hadn't had salary increases for multiple years. They did this past year. They will this next year because of the legislature and the new budget. We're very pleased with that. So for our adjunct faculty, over time, we have to bring up their salaries. And we also have talked about taking adjuncts that are teaching multiple sections and giving them the opportunity to have a full-time position. Now, obviously, tenure is the term that's equated with sort of permanence, but giving people stability and the opportunity to feel a better part of the community is what we want to do.
Do you know what the ratio of full-time to adjunct faculty is at UNC Charlotte?
I don't have it offhand. Okay. No.
So let's talk about one of the goals the school set for itself years ago, becoming recognized as a research university. And we've done many programs with several professors in various different academic disciplines that deal with that. Why was that a goal? And what will it mean if you achieve this so-called tier one status as a research university?
Well, and again, I think that was tied to, it wasn't necessarily that we said, gee, this would be a really great thing. It was the conversation with the community that the view was there is an importance of having a top tier research university for businesses. You think about startups that might come out of the university. You think about connections for research ideas. You think about students and faculty working with the industry. So what we've seen is a continuing progression of increased research, and our research funding was up nearly 12% last year. So we continue to look at that. And then we look at the businesses who have come here saying, I want to be near a research university. And the more you can do, the better that would be for us, because we like to generate new ideas and think about where we're going. We want to collaborate.
Would it also be accurate to say that the bigger, the better the reputation you build in that area of academics, that that attracts more and more higher quality professors?
Of course, yes. Yeah.
Because they want the opportunity to do the research that interests them.
Sure. But I will say that, I mean, a lot of our research interests the faculty, but we're sort of looking at the programs and areas for growth that help fuel the region. So, you know, we're continuously talking about computer science and engineering and the things that are helping this broader area.
You mentioned two things already in this conversation that I know that you're engaged in, and that one is the research that led to the testing of the wastewater during COVID, which has been spread around the country now, and the other is artificial intelligence. I don't know that many people understand that the university is deep in the throes of that. How so?
Well, I mentioned earlier the Engineering North Carolina, and we have a College of Computing and Informatics. We're excited about the work that they're doing. So between artificial intelligence and cybersecurity, we have those academic programs that continue to elevate what's going on in our research centers. And I think it's been very exciting as we look to see what we're going to do next. We did get extra money to build out our engineering and computer science program. We'll add 2,000 students in these programs over the next several years to be able to continue to help the state of North Carolina.
Is becoming a tier one university in that area, is that something that has an official designation? And whether it does or not, where are you on the road to that goal?
to becoming a tier one research mm-hmm. university. Mm-hmm. Where are we? We are probably 7 to 10 years out. So I think that's one of the reasons our strategic plan is a 10-year plan, is we wanted to be able to have a big audacious goal out there. And if we had a 5-year plan, we weren't going to be able to hit that. So we're at just over $58 million a year annually in external research funding. We need to be up over $100 million a year. So we know that we've got a lot of work, but we also have seen the sort of continuous increase in what we're doing to be able to get to that point.
For years, Charlotte bemoaned that it was one of the larger cities in the country without a medical school. We are getting that medical school now. And Ed emails us, will UNC Charlotte ever have a law school? Should it? And if so, what are you doing to make it happen?
Well, thank you, Ed. I would tell you that
that's Ed Williams, by the way, from the formerly with the Charlotte Observer.
I've heard that before, and we certainly continue to look at it. I think that's been a conversation. I also know that, you know, we will assess over time. It's not something that we're looking at right now. And law schools with their separate accreditation have great cost associated with it. And we would want to balance out what is the cost and the need over time.
When you have Chapel Hill that has a law school, would there
right.
be political problems with starting one here?
Well, that's just it. And obviously, as part of the system, we would have to have that conversation with the system as a whole. But that's you know, that's not something that it's out there as a conversation, but it's not something that we're looking at or proactively moving toward.
Speaking of political challenges, there has been much gnashing of teeth and wasting of printer's ink on what's going on between the legislature and the UNC system, particularly in Chapel Hill. There are worries that the legislature has inserted itself too much into the workings of the university system. We have this reputation nationally of having one of the great university systems in the country, and many feel that they are diminishing that reputation. I know this puts you in a tricky position. What's your take on that?
Well, I think in some ways we're fortunate. We're in Charlotte, so we have a distance effect. We have a great working relationship with both, obviously, the system and the legislature. And I think that conversation is going on, and it's not impacting us here at this university. And I'd say, you know, that conversation will continue to go on, but I'd suggest that it's much more of an issue on other campuses and other locales.
Basketball was the first big sport at UNC Charlotte, given the fact that they made the NCAA Final Four in the 70s. Recently, yes. In the last several years, you started a football program and built a stadium, and there are a lot of people who wonder whether sports and colleges really go together. Does it diminish academics? Does it put too much emphasis on sports, etc.? To you, as a university chancellor, what is the importance of a successful athletic department and successful basketball and football programs and other sports that are played intercollegiately?
Yeah, so I think athletics is an opportunity for the community to look at what's happening at a university. It provides a window into the university, or some people refer to it as the front porch of the university. People outside of this campus look and see what's happening, and then they might find out we have bioinformatics and we have artificial intelligence and cybersecurity programs and a fantastic English and math department. So I would say that it just gives you an opportunity to look further.
And that's kind of the elevator speech I was going to ask you about as well, but we're out of time, so I can't. Dr. Sharon Gaber, Chancellor of the University of North Carolina at Charlotte, thank you so much for the hour. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.